Okay, I'm here with Cameron McEwen again. This is session number 8, I think. And we're looking at my pamphlet, my broadside, or booklet. And we ended up last session talking about the interior landscape. And Cameron would like to see if he could define it some more. So what would you say, Cameron?
Yeah, so... First, I just want to mention that when McLuhan came in 1969 to collect his early literary criticism, he called it the interior landscape. So one of the things that signals is that the interior landscape is nothing sort of interior to the body. It's nothing physiologic. It's an attempt to see if there's some way to utilize the plurality of media to get a new sort of orientation.
Did you know that Don Thiel objected to Tom Wolfe's description of the nervous system, the biological, the whatever the term is, the physiological, and he said that missed McLuhan's point? Sounds like Thiel was agreeing with you.
Yeah, that's, to me, that sounds right. I'm not familiar with that in Thiel, but I think that's absolutely correct. We have to understand that something is at stake in McLuhan that he constantly compares to the advent of literacy in Athens in 400 BC approximately, and to the advent of print in the middle of the 15th century, 2,000 years later. What he sees as happening is the revelation of a whole new world on the basis of technological developments comparable to those two events.
Yeah, I just want to say, I think I said McLuhan agrees with you. I meant Thiel. Don Thiel agrees with you.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
I agree with Thiel. He was there before me. And,
right.
Is more familiar with McLuhan than me.
Yeah, he did a whole chapter criticizing Tom Wolfe in his book, The Virtual Marshall McLuhan, I think. One of his books. I think it was that one. You know, he made a point of this. He actually, in a way, he agreed with you. He didn't think anybody who was known as a McLuhan expert or McLuhanite or a writer on McLuhan got close to what McLuhan was about.
Right, right. And it's not even a question of being close, because close is term that implicates continuity and is therefore... Gutenberg galaxy notion.
Yes.
So what's needed is a revolution. And when we're talking about interior landscape, we're talking about what kind of revolution does he think is both possible and necessary. So he spoke constantly about us needing to come up with what he called a survival strategy. And his notion of the interior landscape has to do with how he thought it might be possible for human beings and human civilization to survive.
Yeah, now, was he trying to get it back to the ancient philosophers' idea, say Plato, Aristotle, or people before them? Or was it unique what he was coming up with?
No, not unique. As you have brought out in previous conversations, it was critical for McLuhan that all of a sudden we had multimedia, that we were bombarded by media, and that allowed for the first time to understand the field of media. That might be called the interior landscape, by the way. So the field of media includes everything that has ever been thought or experienced, including everything that could have been fodder experience. And to understand that, you just have to think of chemistry for a minute. When chemistry began around 1800, what was at stake was everything that had ever happened physically and everything that could have happened physically. So there had never been an atomic explosion, for example, but even though that was going to be new, it would be explained in terms of what had always been going on.
Yeah. And that's,
right, so,
that's your basic thesis you told me and Mark in 98, your chemical elements
that's
point.
Correct.
Right?
That is correct. And that basically, when I use chemistry in relationship to McLuhan, what I'm talking about is the possibility of pattern recognition in a multimedia environment.
Mm.
Right? And the confirmation that pattern recognition is possible is rigorous investigation of the field. So Hegel already, around in the first decades of the 19th century, said that there is only one proof for the possibility of science, and that is the actuality of it. He pointed out that it's useless to talk about maybe there's science or the possibility of science is this and that. People have claimed that forever. The only real test is what happened with chemistry in the 19th century, and that is that industrialists began to use chemistry to produce paint, right, or to produce gunpowder. So then it became built into the economy that pattern recognition of a certain kind directed to the physical world produced practical results. And that is, in my opinion, that's what McLuhan was aiming at. You know, when you often bring up the idea of turning down the thermostat, the media thermostat in different areas. And for me, what's at stake there is the practical application of pattern recognition within the multimedia field. But in order to understand the interior landscape better, what I'd like to do is talk first just a minute about the exteriorization of chemistry, right? And so in 1800, when people began to discern a new way of recognizing what was going on in the physical world, this could be called the exteriorization of chemistry, although nothing in the history of the universe had ever not been chemistry. So what happened with the exteriorization of chemistry was that it became theorized, and then once it was theorized, over the next 200 years coming up to where we are now, a whole new world evolved. A new world in which those patterns that were recognized were used for practical effect in economics, and they were used to design courses at the university. They were used for patents, and a whole new world was developed on the basis of what had always been the case.
Mm.
So a new world in medicine, a new world in biology, a new world in genetics, all of this depended upon the initial pattern recognition of people like Priestley and Lavoisier just before 1800.
Did you come up? Oh, no, I'll let you finish. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say that the exteriorization of consciousness is a parallel to that. So the exteriorization of consciousness isn't like the blob from outer space or something like this, although there's a certain insight in science fiction and in surrealism about what this new field is like. But the exteriorization of consciousness is something that has not even begun yet, because pattern recognition hasn't been directed to the field of multimedia, and the practical results, which would be the only proof of that pattern recognition, have not at all been discerned or utilized.
Right. I want to ask you, did you come up with this notion by yourself, or were you reading something about Lavoisier or Priestley? Where did this notion about reality being arrived at with chemistry, where did you get that from?
Well, when you say reality being arrived at with chemistry, I think I'm not sure that that's exactly right. I mean, chemistry gets at what's going on in the field of physical reality, but at the leading edge of science, there are always unknowns, and science works through unknowns. So it's not the case that we come to a sudden illumination. Instead, we learn how to use obscurity in a new way. And that's similar with the multimedia environment, where all that's wanted is a way of looking at the interior landscape, a way of recognizing its patterns, which allows research to take off. Now, and then once it takes off, there'll be all sorts of new findings, new sciences, but the edge of those sciences will always be a certain obscurity that actually provides a way forward for those sciences. So when we look at it that way and ask the question you asked, then two professors that I had at Princeton were formative for these ideas. First, Thomas Kuhn, who wrote The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and he was my advisor just a couple of years after the first appearance of that book. So from Kuhn, I had the idea that that scientific revolution is possible, and that it needs to be differentiated sharply from what he called normal science. I also had the idea with Kuhn, and this was an idea he didn't like, I had the idea that in the present state of knowledge, I didn't call anything the field of multimedia in those days, but the state of thought, you could say, I thought was very obscure, and that this obscurity might be, if we interrogated it, it might be the sort of obscurity that's on the leading edge of science, or if science hasn't begun yet, it could be like the initiation of science. So Kuhn thought, you know, I'm an idiot. The guy's an idiot. He's, 20 years old. He doesn't know anything about what we're talking about. So the sooner he forgets that stuff and gets into the real history of science, the better we'll be.
And he told you that?
No, well, I mean,
politely.
In so many words, he did. I mean, he basically said, look, these are big ideas. Why don't you learn how to detail them, right? Get your hands dirty. Get into the workings of science. And basically, he said to me the same thing as the other professor, and that was Richard Rorty. And Richard Rorty in those days was quite a young faculty member and often was the leader of what are called preceptorial meetings at Princeton. So Princeton doesn't have tutors like Oxford does, but it does have preceptors. And preceptors have meetings with like five students, let's say, or six. Or at least it did in those days. I don't know if they have the system now or not. But when you were taking any sort of course, it could be Greek philosophy, pragmatism, linguistic philosophy, whatever, Rorty would often be one of the preceptors. Hmm. So in those days, he was known as an analytic philosopher, but I had him for courses on Sartre and Nietzsche and Wittgenstein and all sorts of stuff that Rorty became known for only a decade or two later.
Yeah, when you were a student of him, he wasn't famous.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Because you were a student of two professors who you could say became more famous than McLuhan.
Oh, well, I think that's for sure.
Yeah.
Definitely.
That's amazing.
More famous than McLuhan. Yes.
Were they challenging as teachers or?
Absolutely, absolutely. I did all kinds of papers for Rorty because the way that these preceptorial sessions would work often was you would be assigned a paper to do. Could be in 1 week or 2 weeks or something, often based on a book or a chapter in a book. And then the preceptor would ask questions on the basis of those papers. If you were lucky, the preceptor would give you back your paper and would have marked it up in various ways.
Hmm.
And often the papers I would get back from Rorty would often have the sorts of questions that analytic philosophers were famous for in those days. Questions like, what do you mean here? Do you know what this word really means?
Hmm.
Things like that. And come to find out, that's the sort of question that McLuhan took up in the late stages of his University of Manitoba education, and then took it up in spades with Richards and Leavis and Empson in Cambridge, where the great question was, how can we treat the ambiguity of language that is instructive? How can ambiguity be treated in a way that isn't fatally ambiguous itself and becomes sort of useless as a overview?
Right. Now, the point that Kuhn thought was ridiculous, you stuck to that. Did you decide
right.
he was wrong, that you had a relevant question?
Well, sort of. I just knew that I was studying Nietzsche. I did my undergraduate thesis on Nietzsche, and I had the notion from Nietzsche that we were in a cul-de-sac and that we needed to find some way to get out of that cul-de-sac. And so I more or less dedicated my life for the next 10 or 15 years to the question of, is it possible to get out of this cul-de-sac? And if it is, how is it? And
that would be in the 80s and 90s?
No, that was in the, I graduated in 66. So from 66 until, let's say, 78, sometime around there, that's all I was doing was thinking about that one question about the cul-de-sac.
Right. Is that when you went to seminars, summer workshops and things? I remember you telling me you did that. Maybe that was later.
Right. Yeah, that was a few years later when I had the crazy idea. Once I had the notion that it might be possible to get out of the cul-de-sac and how, then I got the idea that, well, I'll just start going to seminars and I'll just go and meet with people. I would make appointments with people. For example, John Robinson, who was the guy that was doing the Nag Hammadi Gnostic manuscripts. He was a professor at Claremont, which is not too far from L.A., and that's I was living in L.A. at the time. And so I made an appointment with him, and I went out and I tried to show how the Gnostic Gospels lead into cul-de-sacs but don't have any way to get out. And I tried to show him that there was a way to get out of these things, but you had to take the Gospels as a plurality. But he didn't, I don't know if he didn't understand, or he was very non-communicative about the whole thing. He just sort of dismissed what I was trying to talk to him about and indicated that he didn't want to take these things further. And that was it for my, I had an hour and a half or something with him, and that was it. But I began to visit other people like McLuhan, like James Hillman in Dallas, like John O'Neill in Toronto. And John was very helpful to me because he was one of the few people that said, this is interesting stuff. If you go to Merleau-Ponty, I think you'll find some related stuff. So why don't you go to him and then get back to me on the basis of his books? And I did. And John, indicated that that was interesting, and that if I approached his books in that spirit, that I might find it helpful, etc. So
you were saying Merleau-Ponty. That's how I say it.
Yeah. Well, Merleau. Yes.
Merleau-Ponty.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you go ahead.
Well, the French just call him Merleau.
Oh, okay, so you, I went to his grave in 2016 in Pierre Lachaise, is it, in Paris?
Uh-huh.
The famous cemetery. I'm pretty sure he was there.
Yes. Yeah.
But you visit McLuhan in 70. That's 4 years after 66. So you're, this pursuit, this focus on this question includes the meeting with McLuhan that early.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So what, so by the late 70s, did something change? When did you get into McLuhan seriously?
Well, I had always been reading his books, and so I had ideas from McLuhan that were kind of percolating in the back of my brain. So I didn't really appreciate what was going on with McLuhan until maybe in the 1980s. I had read the books, the ideas were percolating, but I hadn't sort of fit them into what I thought was going on with different people. And then in the 80s, I got the idea that his notions could be aligned with stuff that I had from Hegel or Plato.
Mm.
And that was already related to the chemistry idea. And so by the time we met and talked in the late 90s, I already had sort of figured out how I wanted to speak about this in terms of McLuhan.
Right. So do you think the incredible for the 80s, or for people coming out of the 70s, the multimedia environment of the 80s, I call it mixed corporate media, MTV, CNN, all these things. Do you think that brought you back into thinking about McLuhan a little more?
It's certainly possible. A lot of the stuff that goes on with thought is not intentional.
Yeah.
McLuhan constantly talks about how media do not affect us through ideas and thought. They affect the perception that is sort of below thought.
Yes.
And so I don't discount what you're saying at all. McLuhan's whole idea was that since, let's say, 1900, in all kinds of fields, the idea from the Gutenberg galaxy that there was one sort of rationality and one way that all sciences were headed was just nonsense. And that people, say from the time of Baudelaire at least, had recognized that the that rationality was a natural plurality, and that if we were really to understand human beings, we had to understand them across the whole spectrum of their possibilities. So not just the great thinkers in the universities, but the laborer walking through Paris.
Yeah, now is this, what is your meaning for plurality? You use that a lot.
That's right. And that's the reason for that is that if plurality is basic, if you can never get around the plurality of media, never get around the plurality of perceptions, that means that there is something special about the border between between and defining this natural plurality, right? If there weren't something special about the border of media, something that fundamentally real about the border between media, then they wouldn't be plural. They would be singular.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Okay, have you ever looked at Zingroni's book, The Media Simplex?
No.
He talks about the preconscious a lot. He had
mm-hmm.
he had a friend in the Psychoanalytic North American Association, and I think he learned a lot about the preconscious. Does that strike you as something that maybe you're talking about rather than the unconscious?
Yeah, but there's a big danger there, and that is that The whole way the Gutenberg galaxy operates is that it tries to find something singular that it can identify that lacks ambiguity, and then it can explain ambiguity in terms of that singularity. So, you know, the preconscious is dangerous in that if it's not seen as ambiguous, then it's going to be useless for coming to terms with the electric environment, because the electric environment is fundamentally ambiguous. So that's one of the markers of the Gutenberg galaxy. McLuhan always says it's continuous, that it's, let me just see if I have a decent quote here for you.
Well, it's continuous, sequential, homogeneous, uniform.
Yeah,
he had
exactly.
A bunch of words he'd repeat all the time.
That is exactly right.
Yeah.
And if the preconscious is allowed to be a kind of fixed marker, then everything that is explained via that fixed marker is going to be continuous with it in some way. And you end up with a sort of crystal palace overview of whatever you're investigating, in this case, McLuhan. And this is going to be completely different from what McLuhan was talking about.
Right.
Although, we must say that one of the interesting things in both Joyce and McLuhan is that they insist that you cannot have a fundamental plurality without accounting for sin, without accounting for false views, without accounting for the deep reality of fundamental mistakes. Right? So if you want to have multimedia as your sort of your basis, then part of your fundament is how human beings constantly go wrong.
Yeah, now, McLuhan regarded poetry as traditional poetry, last, say, 500 years, as introducing, retrieving ambiguity in juxtaposition to the scientists. Would you agree?
Yes, but I think that when McLuhan is at his best, then he would insist that there is no such thing as the poetry of the last 500 years, and there's no such thing as science like that. If we want to fundamentally come to grips with the electric environment, we have to let all terms be ambiguous, and we have to let ambiguity be our fundamental clue.
Right. So, Carpenter and them in the explorations, they had their fields, but McLuhan's field was poetry, they would say, and that he thought that was the deeper field than theirs. Is poetry, excellent poetry or serious poetry, is that part of the Gutenberg galaxy? Printed poetry. In the sense that it's pointing out ambiguity in language to counter the precision of the calculus, the mathematicians, and the scientists, and the chemists.
Well, you see, Bob, I just think that when we talk like that, the danger is to think that we can fix what great poetry is, or what even what calculus is, or what science is. And McLuhan, at his best, doesn't work like that at all. What McLuhan does is say that there is a natural ambiguity to everything.
Okay.
So, for example, figure and ground.
Right.
What McLuhan does, he says, let's take figure and ground and apply that to poetry and science, which you were just talking about.
Yeah.
And he'll say at one extreme, we have poetry as ground and science as figure. And here, at this extreme, anything that's valuable in science as figure is going to have its ground in poetry. And then he's going to go to the other extreme, where science is the ground and poetry is the figure. And here, anything that's valuable in poetry is going to have its ground in science. And between these two extremes, there is what McLuhan calls a myriad of other possibilities. But they're all figure-ground possibilities. And they have to do with what he sometimes calls the stress, sometimes calls the preference, sometimes calls the weight, of how the figure and ground are configured. Right, so this is not only a critique of how people work in the humanities, it's also a guide to how that work can actually be done. It takes advantage of ambiguity, but says that ambiguity itself has a pattern that can be recognized. And the recognized pattern of ambiguity is the spectrum between these two extremes that we just mentioned.
Right. So the term Gutenberg galaxy has to be ambiguous.
Absolutely. It is a sign of the Gutenberg galaxy that it is always double, but double in a kind of a derivative way. If the Gutenberg galaxy and we shouldn't call the Gutenberg galaxy a singular thing, right? It was for hundreds of years, there were people thinking and doing very different things, but subject to a recognizable pattern that is the Gutenberg galaxy. But the pattern of the Gutenberg galaxy is always to see something doubled that has a singular reality. So the figure ground that is at work in the Gutenberg galaxy is a figure ground configuration that wants to give itself up in some overwhelming question, as Prufrock says.
Yeah.
Right? It the Gutenberg galaxy is all of those ways of attempting to find closure that either begin or end in singularity. So it's not that the Gutenberg galaxy lacks ambiguity. It's got ambiguity in spades. However, it always attempts to find some ground that can overwhelm its figure, or conversely, some figure that can overwhelm its ground. So McLuhan, or I should say maybe Eric especially, like to talk about figures without ground.
Yes. When Marshall said this can be shown by empirical means, the way he used the word empirical, is that what you're trying to say about the elements of chemistry?
Absolutely, absolutely. He's McLuhan's trying to say that these spectra of ambiguity can be seen to be at work any time anything is said or written or whatever. And if we were serious about what we were doing, we would start with this range of ambiguity and see how it worked. And seeing how it works is what he meant by empiricism.
Right. Okay, so the next thought was, I don't know of any sentence that he wrote that you say, few minutes ago, you said, McLuhan was pointing to the multiple possibilities, blah, blah, blah. Where did he actually say those words?
Oh, he constantly was talking about that because, for example, when he talks about the unconscious, what he's talking about there is everything that could possibly be experienced by human beings.
Right, but I don't recall him saying the word possibilities.
No, but ever. I think you're probably right. I'll try and find something
near that.
Yeah, but what he does talk about all the time is the dynamics, right? So he talks about a dynamic world, or sometimes he talks about the drama, for example, the drama of cognition.
Yes.
And what he's whole concept of dynamics goes back to Aristotle. And it was Aristotle's attempt to show that people weren't understanding his teacher Plato correctly when they thought of the forms of thought being somehow abstracted from the world, or up in the sky and the clouds, like in Aristophanes' play, The Clouds. Aristotle tried to show is that the forms of thought have an inherent need to outer themselves, to empty themselves, to make themselves real, you could say. And so what Aristotle was pointing to here is that you can imagine the world as having its reality in ideas that are completely separated from the world. Or you can think about the world having its reality in terms of matter that is completely separated from the ideas. Or in the third place, you can think about ideas as inherently needing to realize themselves. And that's what the dynamic is. Right, dynamic is the push, if you will, of a form to be realized. So you can see here that there are three different types of realities that Plato already talked about, and that Aristotle then again talked about following Plato. And in these three types of realities, You have the extreme of ideas without relation to matter. You have matter without relation to ideas. And then in the middle, you have ideas that are constantly realizing themselves in matter. And you can see that 2,500 years later, when chemistry is born, the whole idea of chemical elements is that they're not at all abstracted from matter, and matter isn't at all abstracted from chemical elements, but that chemical elements are matter. But on the one hand, they're ideas that can be formulated strictly in theory, and on the other hand, they're realized in everything all around us. So McLuhan's when McLuhan talks about dynamics, and when he talks about drama, he's talking about something that's vertical, not horizontal. And when something is vertical, then it's the drama of cognition that issues from media into reality. And the two can be separated in thought, the media on the one hand and the reality on the other, but they when they are separated, that's a secondary thing. The primary thing is that media have this urge to realize themselves. And that's what happens in the drama of cognition, and it's what happens in anything in the psychological field whatsoever.
Right. Now, the three approaches you said 3 minutes ago, can you map the trivium on each one?
That's what McLuhan tried to do, right? If we think about McLuhan's career, he started off studying at the University of Manitoba, and by 1930 or so, he had already decided that Rupert Lodge in philosophy was the guy that he needed to work with.
Mm.
And he worked closely with Lodge for several years. And Lodge's primary idea was that philosophy comes in three flavors: idealism, realism, and pragmatism. And so McLuhan had this notion of a threefold reality from Lodge, and then reading philosophers with Lodge like Hegel, that became reinforced. And so then when 10 years later, he's writing his thesis on the trivium, the rhetoric becomes the material side. It's how how words are materialized in, let's say, politics or in any practical field. Rhetoric is exercise.
Yeah.
And then dialectic is the idealistic side, where whatever is going on has a conceptual reality to it. And then grammar is in the middle. And grammar is the study of how things are to be understood. That is to say, you're going to use ideas like dialectic does, but you're going to be applying them and deriving them from the practical world. And so in his PhD thesis, he is still very much involved with his Professor Lodge influence, and he's trying to see if there is a way of applying that threefold to the world. And the great question he's going to interrogate all during the 1940s is it's one thing to say that there's a threefold that can be applied to the world and all this sort of stuff, but this will only work if you can find a rigorous way of identifying what is rhetoric, what is dialectic, and what is grammar. And so then if we fast forward from 1942, let's say, when he was writing up his thesis, his PhD thesis on Nash, we fast forward to 1958, when he's talking with Harry Scornia about his the project that they're going to try and finance through the federal government. McLuhan writes a paper that was never published, but it's available online in the NAB files, and it's called The Grammars of Media. And what McLuhan has come to the idea over, this is 16 or 17 years later, he's come to the idea that we need to, if we want to rigorously define what he was trying to get at with the trivium, we need to look at all of the different media, but we have to look at them as if each were a language with its own grammar. And that becomes, that's 1958, he's going to live for another 20 years, that becomes his sort of leading thought. If we're really dealing with grammars of media, how do we specify what a grammar is? And using that, how do we specify what a medium is? And then that sort of unlocks everything and gets us out of the cul-de-sac.
Yeah. What about Aquinas' idea of the form as assuming the opposite before it becomes itself? Remember, he used to quote that a lot, that something is becoming, well, the day is becoming day while it is night.
Correct. So the...
is that part of ambiguity?
Well, yes, it shows the it's an illustration of the natural ambiguity of things, but it also it's when McLuhan quoted stuff like that, he was largely interested in the question of multiple times, because it turns out that if you want to look at the dynamics of thought, which is to say the drama of cognition, which is to say the vertical genesis of thought, then you need to have a plural notion of time, because you need to have the idea that perception is generated in a different time from linear chronology, right? We don't, when we're generating our thoughts, it's not as if we go from moment to moment thinking up some way of looking at the world. Some way of looking at the world has always already happened. We can't get at it through a linear chronology. We need to imagine that there is a different kind of time in which perception is generated. And that then brings forward multiple questions like, who does this, right? And where is it done? If there's multiple times, and there must be multiple spaces, and there must be some shadowy kind of entity that operates in this region, but it's not what I am. It's prior to my identity. And so by the end of his life, McLuhan will say, well, that's the nobody. That's, that's the dropout.
Yeah.
That's the peculiar entity that is between media, right?
Yeah.
And it's because media are inherently plural, with this strange gap between them, which you would call the gap of tactility, the haptic gap, in that gap, there is a kind of frontiersman, right? This is the frontier between media.
Yeah.
And in that frontier, everybody is a nobody. But you can see how this relates to the map of ambiguity that we were talking about before. There's this spectrum of ambiguity, and in between the various figure ground configurations, in fact, even between figure and ground, there is a peculiar gap. And what McLuhan will say, and this goes way back to Plato and perhaps even back to Egypt, the navigator of these gaps being the navigator of these gaps is what human being is.
Yes. Now, would you say the Marconi galaxy, when we move into that, say 150 years ago, does that mean a new emphasis on the quadrivium?
Maybe. I know this is an idea that you like, and it appears in your book, actually.
Yes.
But I'm not sure about that. I think, for my way of thinking about it, the trivium is inherently plural, and it wouldn't be plural if there was only the trivium, right? So the whole notion of inherent plurality is one that is explosive, right? For McLuhan, it's explosive in the way that it generates plurality, but it's implosive related to the Gutenberg galaxy because it blows up the crystalline closures of the Gutenberg galaxy.
Yes, but so I suspect your understanding of interior landscape comes in here.
When
I say we move into the quadrivium, which is music, and he said we live entirely by music, mathematics is number, or arithmetic is number, which he said it was tactile, geometry is visual, and astronomy may be visual.
No, he makes a big point of saying that the geometry is visual only for the Gutenberg galaxy.
Yes.
So you don't have geometry prior to literacy. But what happens in the 19th century is that Poland and other places, the geometry of the straight line between points is blown up.
Yeah.
And you have a whole series of geometries plural. And that plurality is the signature of the Marconi era.
Right. So we have a different meaning for geometry in the Marconi era.
Right.
So you got music. Music, arithmetic, geometry can be non-visual. Then astronomy, does that get into kinetics through Newton?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look, the... what happens in 1900 with the Planck constants and then shortly thereafter with Einstein's papers is that the whole idea of astronomy as it had been thought gets blown up.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, it gets what leads to these problems is what was called the black body problem. And it was that... The chemistry and physics of the 19th century couldn't account for discrepancies that seemed to happen when you heated up a body and then it started to cool off and you tried to figure out how the cooling process worked. The numbers didn't come out right. Mm. And so that was an indication, this black body theory. My teacher, Thomas Kuhn, one of his books after The Structure of Scientific Revolution is on black body theory.
Mm.
So when the black body problem was interrogated, that led to a revolution in astronomy.
Yeah,
ultimately.
So, you're supporting my case that the Marconi galaxy is more quadrupial than trivial.
Well, you see, I don't like notions of more than and stuff. That gets into continuity and linearity and
People talk about McLuhan's, you know, emphasis on the trivium. Never talk about the quadrivium. So I'm emphasizing the quadrivium to bring that back into at least a equal contender in categorizing McLuhan, which may not be.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with the what I see is lying behind your emphasis on that is that you're insisting on a plurality. You're insisting that if you start with something like the trivium and say that's what McLuhan's all about, then you simply haven't understood that for him ambiguity is fundamental.
Yeah.
That the trivium is not one thing. So if you imagine the figure ground spectrum, then you can imagine the trivium as figure and the quadrivium as ground, and then at the other extreme, the opposite.
Yeah.
And if you haven't taken account of that inherent ambiguity, then you have remained in the Gutenberg galaxy. And what I am in the process of arguing, and what I'm going to argue more pointedly going forward, is that all McLuhan scholarship up until now has had no other function but to attempt to haul him back into the Gutenberg galaxy.
I agree.
It's ridiculous.
Do you see what I'm trying to say in my book, always in quotes, it's in alignment to your purpose?
Yes, I think so. One of the things that I have to learn better from you is that McLuhan certainly did speak about displacement of media, so that when you have a new medium, it displaces all of the media before.
Yeah.
And that that mechanism for McLuhan is very important in trying to understand what a medium is, and it's also very important in trying to understand what is going on in our history, let alone, you know, the history of the past. So I see your work as dedicated to that side of McLuhan, and it's something that's definitely there, and it's you're able in your Bob-like way to come up with ways of talking about this that are they're enjoyable and they're more or less unique to you.
Yeah.
And I find them very revealing. So when we keep going through your book, I think we'll find illustrations of you doing this over and over again.
Yes. You flipped me off there talking about me, but just before that, we were talking. The Gutenberg galaxy creates a tendency to move towards singular precision. And the electric age creates a tendency to move to the pluralities, or the multiple levels. Now, these are tendencies, and that might be the meteorological, that's the ground, and McLuhan is taught it can show all these fields and human endeavors have the aspect of the Marconi atmosphere as opposed to the Gutenberg atmosphere. So when does that become practical, that notion? Or what he's trying to show us, is it only practical in the sense that, well, we know it's going to keep going this way and even stranger ways, we better do a retreat that might get us out of the cul-de-sac of always going to new environments and missing what's going on. And another aspect is the word, when he says the medium is the message, the medium is all the technologies that we know. And the new technology, which is a figure, is causes changes. We start to notice that the medium starts to be stirred up, because the medium is all the past institutions. See, but most people thought that when he said the medium is a message, the word medium was a word for television or satellites. When actually,
right.
And I lay this out where he kind of says that in the mid-70s, changes the surface meaning of medium to mean all that was already there. And we can only notice something new's afoot when there's disturbances in the past or the medium we're using and are used to.
Yeah, that's all correct. The only thing is, you cannot get to McLuhan's suggestions by thinking that there is some way of kind of freezing what you're talking about.
Yeah,
it's not the case that we can take quote unquote all media and freeze it as ground, and then take some medium and say, well, that's the iPhone, and stick that as the figure. No, for McLuhan, this spectrum of figure and ground can never be got around. Everything is inherently ambiguous, and there only are laws of media because of that ambiguity. And go ahead.
Yeah, and so that's what the McLuhan industry does. They don't get that.
Absolutely.
They try to say, well, no, this is precise, or do the opposite of what you're saying. They move away from ambiguity. And they think that, well, there is a point McLuhan's saying it's hard to figure out. And if you don't make an aside, say, well, it's hard to figure out because it's ambiguous. If you drop that and just say, no, here it is. So I was just thinking as you were talking there that the voice takes over the role of the book and becomes precise, or appears to be precise, when we're into the post-verbal media, multiple spaces we're in. So the oral retrieval is a content. We're not oral. We're not an oral society today, because we use the orality too much to pretend to seem to get precise.
Right, but just remember that orality is not one thing and precision is not one thing. So it's McLuhan's whole suggestion is that if we give up singularities, then we can begin to research. And we can't say what that research is going to realize. All we can do is say that that research will revolutionize the world, just as literacy once did, or just as print once did. The whole point is to start, but we cannot start if we insist on singularities.
And so what in popular culture is a major term that people use more and more the last 10, 15 years is singularity. They're all talking about the singularity.
Correct.
They think the world is imploding to a singularity. And you just established that, no, it's the incorrect word, unless you have an ambiguous meaning for it.
No, and even in physics, singularity is often seen to be a plural.
Oh, is it?
So, absolutely, because a singularity is like a black hole, is where physical laws leave off.
Yeah.
And we inherently don't know what's going on in a black hole simply because the physical laws break down. So, but now we know that there's a whole bunch of different black holes, and it's one theoretical path in physics is the idea of multiple universes, and then other paths in science and physics have to do with the possibility of wormholes and all this sort of stuff. So it's increasingly recognized that singularities are plural, and that maybe that gives us an important clue to what's going on.
Yes, so we have people saying, overusing the word singularity, And it's the correct word if you know the meaning you just outlined. But people probably don't mean that meaning. They just think it means...
No, that's right.
What'd you say?
Right. But, no, you're absolutely right. What you're doing is you're saying, isn't there something important about people going wrong?
Yeah.
About people talking about a singularity, which ultimately doesn't make sense. And that's in both Joyce and McLuhan, there is this notion that unless you can account for, not in the sense of some unbreakable law or something, but account for in their terms means something like talk sensibly about, learn how to value.
Mm.
So if we learn how to value singularity in the wrong sense, what we can say is that the culture is attempting to digest the disintegration of the Gutenberg galaxy. And the Gutenberg galaxy is the temptation to go from ambiguity to some sort of closure, to
yeah.
some sort of singularity, right?
Yes.
So you have people chewing, the culture is in the process of chewing the whole notion of singularity until it can finally digest it. And when it digests it, it will see that it is subject to the same laws of ambiguity that we've already talked about.
Yeah, I think what I was trying to say about the voice taking over as content, McLuhan actually gave us a summary of sociological, psychological studies and aesthetic studies, and he actually got it right. The medium is the message is probably the most valuable thing to teach to high school kids or even younger. So that finally gave the voice something to say. We now know the medium is the message, which is like an elemental chemical rule. But again, that flips into ambiguity because we're not limited to the vocal, verbal anymore. So we have a great renaissance. So a lot of people think they're getting epiphanies and they're actually just realizing what the Gutenberg galaxy was. And that's
yeah.
not the epiphany for the present.
Correct. When you say realizing, have to note the ambiguity of that word.
Yeah.
Right? You can realize something in the sense of bring it to form. Right? And if you realize your potential, what you do is you enable things that are within you in some sort of practical way. And then another meaning of realize is to come to consciousness of. And those are two very different ideas of realize. So what's going on in popular culture is a realization of the Gutenberg galaxy in the sense of bringing its potential to form, but it's not at all realization in the sense of coming to consciousness of. That's what it's attempting to do, but it's not succeeding. And when you say that we now understand the medium as the message, we don't understand that in McLuhan's terms.
Right.
In McLuhan's terms, the only way to understand the medium as the message is to begin rigorous investigation on its basis. And we have none of that.
That's right. The what you were just saying. Realize. REALEYES. We think we've arrived at real eyes, real sight.
Uh-huh.
A pun, a Finneganese on your word there. And then
It's like Percival O'Reilly.
Right. And that's in Finnegan's Wake, for those who don't know, page 44.
and for those that don't know, Percy is per se.
That's right.
And O'Reilly is the real.
Yeah, and O'Reilly is ear, French for ear, and then there's Percy Wyndham Lewis in there.
Yeah.
So then the next thought was, oh, what? Now, what's in light of all you've said, talk about interior landscape, is
right.
what we started
so,
off with.
That's correct. So let me, I think the way to do this is to go back to the quotation from Joyce Aquinas in the Poetic Process that you often bring up, that ends up with digestion. So let me just quickly read what McLuhan has to say here. First, he makes a quotation from Stephen Hero. For Stephen, art was neither a copy nor an imitation of nature. The artistic process was a natural process, a veritably sublime process of one's own nature, which had a right to examination and open discussion. So that's the quotation from Joyce. And that, and Stephen Hero, by the way, for those who don't know, is the early book of Joyce that he completed in Trieste, and that one night in drunken disgust, he threw it in the fire, and Nora was able to rescue
some of
it.
No, his sister. His sister.
Oh, was his sister?
I'm pretty sure.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know, but some of it was rescued. It was eventually published shortly after his death in the early 1940s.
But it was the first version of the portrait of the artist as a young man.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. So.
So you gave us a quote from Stephen Hero.
I gave you a quote from Stephen Hero, and then McLuhan comments that this process is that of ordinary apprehension is made plain. So then he makes another quote from Joyce, right? And also from Stephen Hero. What we symbolize in black, the Chinaman may symbolize in yellow. Each has his own tradition. Greek beauty laughs at Coptic beauty, and the American Indian derides both. It is almost impossible to reconcile all tradition, whereas it is by no means impossible to find the justification of every form of beauty that has ever been adored on earth by an examination of the mechanism of aesthetic apprehension, whether it be dressed in red, white, yellow, or black. And I'll just make an interjection here. There's only one more sentence to go from Joyce. And he hasn't talked at all about physiological digestion. He's talked about perception, and he's going to relate that to digestion, but the whole quotation has to do with psychological digestion, with perception. So now he completes his thought by saying, we have no reason for thinking that the Chinaman has a different system of digestion from that which we have, though our diets are quite dissimilar. And then the final conclusion drawn by Joyce is the apprehensive faculty, not the digestion, the physiological digestion, but the apprehensive faculty must be scrutinized in action. So then McLuhan says, very, very importantly, it is impossible to exaggerate the importance of this last phrase, right? And that last phrase, again, the apprehensive faculty must be scrutinized in action. So if we think of the trajectory of McLuhan's project, he begins around 1930 with working with Professor Lodge, and Lodge says that philosophy comes in three flavors, and McLuhan, in his master's thesis, brings up the idea that it's not just philosophy that comes in flavors, literature does as well. And he brings up the idea in that master's thesis that we need to understand the types of philosophy and literature in ways that go back to Coleridge. And Coleridge, he quotes Coleridge as saying, everybody is born either a Platonist or an Aristotelian. And McLuhan brings this up as indicating a kind of task, an interrogation that has to be made. So here he is in 1951 And the essay that we're just quoting, where McLuhan cites Stefan Hero, and the idea is that the apprehensive faculty must be scrutinized in action, says Joyce, and McLuhan says it's impossible to exaggerate the importance of this last phrase, and we realize that here is McLuhan at age 40, 1951, and he's looking back to how his intellectual life started in 1930, and he's looking ahead to 1958, that is to say, 7 or 8 years after this essay, when he will say the medium is the message. And the medium is the message says that if we want to examine the apprehensive faculty in action, we want to scrutinize it, we have to look at its medium. And if we want to look at its medium, then we have to understand the meaning of media, plural, because no medium can be understood by itself. It needs to be understood in the complete spectrum of possible media.
Right. And so what that last sentence points to, Marshall develops on pages 31, 32, 33 of The Interior Landscape. It's the second Joyce essay, and he goes into using the phrase stages of apprehension, the drama of cognition, the quiddity of the moment, and the art form. I always, I've reread those pages for 40, 50 years. Right. Do you find them appropriate to what we're saying?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. But the single most important thing in what you were just saying is the reconceptualization, the replay, the reimagination of what stages means.
Yes.
If stages is taken in linear fashion, then the drama of cognition can never be understood for a whole bunch of reasons, one of which is it has no phenomenological reality, right? We don't, in perceiving the world, there's no stages, momentary stages that we're aware of. Instead, we have to think about stages in terms of a vertical time, which is not a conscious verbal time, but it's a time that's implicated, right? The word implicate is to fold in etymologically.
Right.
Plicate is the Latin P often becomes F in the German languages, like, Greek pyre and our fire, or Greek pous for foot, et cetera, et cetera. So in implicate, we're talking about an infolding, and it's a word that goes across the Indo-European languages, but it's often disguised. We don't see that plicate and fold is actually the same word. So this, when we're looking at the implicated stages, we have to understand that this is a vertical time, not a horizontal time, number one. And number two, we have to understand that stage is never used by McLuhan in a way that excludes the theatrical stage. So what happens in the drama of cognition is that the possible roles that are brought forth on the stage are in some way reviewed and then are brought into reality, right? So in the stages of cognition, stages of the drama, keyword, of cognition, there's some mysterious process that's carried out by the nobody that has to do with an evaluation of roles. And in that examination of roles, one is selected in some mysterious way and becomes manifest. So now we're back to what we were talking about of dynamics in McLuhan, which ultimately comes from Aristotle.
Yeah, now McLuhan says somewhere back in the 50s and 60s that students think in levels. Now that's the stages, the way you're saying, that's not what McLuhan meant. So he's showing that the students are 19th century minds. They've got the literate habit, so they think in levels. And in popular culture, or just TV interviews with people or talk shows, you'll say, well, there's their new post-Gutenbergian insight is that there's levels. It's a complex society. More and more people now collapse in front of the complexities. But see, that's the linear idea of stages and levels. And
well, it can be a Gutenberg idea, but it can also be a Marconi idea.
Right.
Right. We can't solidify the meaning of levels.
Right, but McLuhan shows when he critiques the students, he shows their limitations. He means the Gutenberg meaning of levels or stages. And
right, because nearly always when McLuhan talks about levels, he talks about multi-levels. And multi-levels for McLuhan are inherently vertical.
Well, they're puns, visual and acoustic. It's a moire, a term that William Irwin Thompson used to use a lot. I don't know why you say it's vertical. What does that mean?
Because everything is figure and ground. Everything has some relation to a medium. And so that means that multi-level is a correlate of the fundamentality of ambiguity, right? The fundamentality of ambiguity is a way of saying that everything is subject to the spectrum of figure-ground possibilities. And every figure-ground possibility is a multi-level structure.
I think figure-ground, as I pointed out last time, is a literate bias. Now, when McLuhan says the world is flat up against your face, that's where we're at today, no perspective. I don't see the verticality in that. You have to close your eyes to maneuver in that situation that visually is everything is on one frontal plane up against your face. You remember him talking
right,
about that?
Yeah, sure, but the problem is, Bob, that what you're trying to do is you're trying to find something that can be fixed in order to explain other stuff. And McLuhan always refuses that.
Yeah.
What McLuhan is thinking about, if you say the world is flat up against our face, Is that something that is bad? Is that something that's sort of a literal fact that we need to accept? What is that? Well, I mean, one of McLuhan's reflex actions is to go to the world of art. And what happens to art around 1900 is that it goes flat.
Yep.
Art is saying that there is something in a flat canvas that is important to say that a more three-dimensional canvas can't say. Right? And so when McLuhan says, okay, the world is flat up against your face, one of the things he's saying is that there's something to be seen there that isn't being seen. And that's nearly always his reflex, right?
It's always what? It's always
his reflex.
Yes.
His reflex is always to try to show where there is ambiguity that hasn't been seen. And the great problem that McLuhan ran into when he became, a talking head in the 1960s was that he kept saying things because he had to use words that he kind of regretted because he would say them, and then people would take them as singularities or something fixed or something.
Yeah.
And he would have to take them back.
Yeah.
Right? And he was always in the position of saying, well, try this, but actually don't try this. Right?
Yeah, he would say, he'd say something about cliche archetype, and then he'd say, well, I may have gotten that backwards.
Exactly. Because of this, the inherent ambiguity.
Yeah.
Right? So that the, you know, you were talking before about singularities, and then you talked about levels, and then you talked about the world sort of coming right up to people's face.
Yeah.
And so all of these may be seen as problems because they are, in a certain way, they're not realizing ambiguities that are there.
Yes.
But for Joyce and McLuhan, the reflex is to say, well, wait a minute. Can something really be without ambiguity? Can something be only bad? Right? Or conversely, can something be only good? And their answer is no. Any attempt at fixation is laughable. Right? And McLuhan says, I forget which essay it is, where he's talking about the misguided missile of existence and the submarine that doesn't work in some way. He says the only answer to this stuff is laughter.
Yes. Now, what?
Right?
How does the word vertical come in here then?
Well, it comes in through the fact that in the interior landscape, what we're talking about is a world that is prior to perception in a certain way, but it's not prior in terms of a linear chronology. A linear chronology always expresses some way of looking at the world, some role, some cliche, but the becoming of that perception of the world is what needs to be interrogated. That's what we're just saying in this quotation from Joyce.
Yeah.
And right, the apprehensive faculty must be scrutinized in action. And that's what McLuhan says in regards to all problems, right? If something is too much up against the face, if it's too singular, if it's insisting on levels in a stupid way, we need to look at these things as clues, right? In chemistry, for example, chemistry wouldn't be chemistry if it said, well, there's certain things that have nothing to do with elements. There's certain things that we don't bother to explain, right? That would be ridiculous. The whole point of chemistry is that there's nothing that isn't chemical. And if we don't know an answer, that's a great finding. That points to something that we can learn. So in the interior landscape, if something is stupid, then that points to something about, well, why is it there? And what can it tell us? And why is it valuable to know that?
Right. Now, 2 points. Remember in Explorations, I think it might be his first essay, Culture Without Literacy, Volume
yep.
1.
Yep.
He has a sentence in there tending towards, I think, near the end, that he's saying, well, our seminar is exploring here, and we have the right of self-correction. Do you remember that?
Absolutely. Well, I don't remember it, but that's an important thing
yes.
that he would always say, and it's that was directed against his fellow seminarians, right?
Yes.
McLuhan felt that even though these were old buddies of his from Winnipeg in the Maine, plus Carpenter that he was a good friend of, and Tyrwhitt that he respected, he didn't think that any of them really understood ambiguity.
Right.
And weren't able to self-correct in a way that would lead them to understand what the seminar was trying to do.
Yes. And the second point, all that he says on pages 31, 32, 33 in Interior Landscape in the second Joyce essay, he drops in where you like to think around the late 50s, and he finally sees tactility. The art form he's thinking about is not Gutenberg art. He's talking about major environments are the art forms. So you could apply those sentences to the new media environment as the art form which has acquittity, but I think they are inadequate, those sentences. And he actually said to me through the Evergreens, the medium that he experienced through Michael Blake Reed, he said, I read some of that stuff to him, those pages. He says, yes, there's a little of confusion there. I didn't have it exact enough or precise, or I was not happy with that, which was interesting because something happens and people notice in the late 50s, early 60s, he drops his Gutenberg concerns. And in 1970, when he says, I'm not writing any more books, he actually could have said that in 1959, 60, 61. But then he had to write a few books because other people were crowding into the media world and getting some, you know, new positioning, and he knew they had it wrong, so to speak, or it was limited. So he had
he also knew that there was a certain amount of money that could be derived from the media field, and he didn't want others to have that money when he and Scornia might have it.
That's right, and that's why he said, you know, help beautify junkyards. Throw something lovely away today. So, understanding meeting Gutenberg Galaxy are things thrown away. And then he's collaborating after that. And that's the important point. You know, he's Marconian. He's not a Gutenberg solo operation. So, but if he could actually get his computer thing going, studying sensory thresholds, it would have been interesting. He does say, apparently, in Marchand's biography that they kind of made mistakes with it, with Daniel Capon and that. Now, I have a letter where Capon stole some of the money. So that's why we don't never hear of Capon after the late 60s. And yet he was the guy qualified to do the statistics and whatever computer type thing they were using. But it would have been interesting if he could have, with better colleagues or better understanding of what they could do, if they could analyze sensory thresholds around the world, which you think is just a thought experiment. But if he could do it, you know, acting it out could still be a thought experiment, you know, actually doing it empirically. It would have been interesting whether he would do that, or did he realize in his manifesto in the Duline newsletter around 1970 that it was a whole new ball game and those kind of management techniques didn't work and we're moving into an apocalyptic situation where, you know, crisis 24/7 and no one with any sane perspective would get the attention.
Right. I think that's a really interesting theme to examine.
Yeah.
I personally think that when McLuhan first came to his mature ideas, which he did in sort of 1956, 57, 58, in that time period, the first
I'll just say, Cameron, in that period, he produced a lot of articles which are very important to read because he spells out that completion. He defines everything. You get some of the definitions you don't find later in the 60s.
Correct.
You know, but it's all spelled out in those articles in the late
60s. Remember that, you know, he's no spring chicken.
Yeah.
Right? This is a man who's coming up to his 50th birthday.
Yeah.
And he does not have his ideas in order. they're very chaotic.
Yeah.
So when he begins to first set out these ideas, the reflex he gets from people every time is, Marshall, these ideas sound very interesting. How can we put them into practical effect?
Yes.
How can we make a curriculum in secondary school? How can we, in the psychology department, how can we test them and stuff? And I think McLuhan, through weakness or through weariness or through sort of an inability to see through all this sort of stuff, gave into them. And he spent a large part of the next decade trying to think how sort of Gutenbergian proof, Gutenbergian demonstration might be made. And that was absurd. That was, you know, he damn near killed himself. He was having his blackouts and mini strokes and all of this sort of stuff. And he had already had severe health problems in 1960. And so for the next 20 years of his life, it was just a horrible record of health. And the guy just kept on slogging along. But he allowed himself to become mislead by the ever repeated demand for how can we demonstrate this?
Yeah.
And when people said that, they were always coming from the Gutenberg galaxy.
Yep.
And McLuhan tried to answer their concerns, and therefore he threw out a kind of sheet anchor for his progress. Right? All of this attempt to demonstrate completely screwed up his thought, because it got away from ambiguity. It got away from the second sight, the insights that he had in this crucial period in the late 1950s.
Right. Now Ted Carpenter says, and he really, you know, he got pretty good understanding of McLuhan, at least early McLuhan. He said he got away from McLuhan when McLuhan went into the meteorological, the global thermostat stuff. So Carpenter maybe intuited that this was the wrong direction, the way you're saying it. And he knew not to hang around with McLuhan anymore, so he disappeared and went to California. And he dropped it. Now, the other thing, though, is McLuhan trying to help the literate guy was an act as a Christian. That was his game. He said, you know, we really can't have Christianity anymore if we keep up with this electronic implosion. But I will try to help my fellow literate guys who are unconscious Christians and explain the crisis. So his sort of, what do you call that, amiability, his general willing to help kind of guy, you know, he could be in a soup kitchen. What you were describing, these mistaken things, was his Christian self trying to stop being a manipian the way he was in the 40s, actually just being a regular guy helping people, which might have been a reaction to the fame he got and the alienation of that in the 60s. So he became local. And actually, I just remember Morris McLuhan told me in 71 that McLuhan was not accepting any lecture assignments or anything outside of Toronto. They did not want to be on an international scale anymore, which was the 60s. They wanted to act locally. And I guess the Spadina Express was an expression of that. But he made a conscious attempt to be an anti-environment to the increasing globality of people's lives. You know, there were jets flying all over the place. He wanted to be a counter to the global village, global theater. So Don Thiel pointed out that, you know, fundamentalists or maybe even Calvinists would celebrate McLuhan because he was accommodating to their visual bias as a Christian.
Well, we were talking earlier about how if there really is a rigorous way of interrogating the interior landscape, then there's nothing that it can't engage with.
Yeah.
Right? Just as chemistry needs to engage everything, and if it finds something that it can't engage, then that's a great moment. You get a Nobel Prize for that.
Yeah.
So then... for McLuhan, engaging with everything is completely natural. If he calls it Christian, I don't think he would say that, except if he were trying to, you know, influence somebody. It is a Christian impulse, but to say that really goes Gutenbergian.
Yeah, I know. In the mid-70s, I think he does that essay for the abortion book. Forget what it was called. But he ends talking about the true church is salvation. What the heck is the true church? Sometimes I think that he was the prophet of the true church. He was seeing how to be a Christian in a new way. You have to look at these media environments as your clothing. And no one had got to that level of how to be ethical. Because
I think that's right. But I would urge you to resist the temptation to find some sort of closure there, as if McLuhan thought that we could already discern the face of the new church. He didn't. He thought it was very important to admit that we can't see where we ought to go.
Yes, and everybody, the literate people all around, they could not dare encounter that question.
Absolutely, because their identity, what they had done with their whole life, hung on it.
Yeah.
So, this gets back into McLuhan's whole relation to his own family. Imagine having this kind of strange relationship with your own identity, and you want to relate to your family in a supportive and educational way. You want to bring them up so that they're whole and happy, you're kind of caught between your own sort of very loose way of relating to the world and what they need.
Yes.
Right? It's a very and the same thing happens with him and his students, or with him and his colleagues. He's always in a difficult position of wanting to relate to them directly, but knowing that all direct relation is ultimately indirect.
Well, he was being dangerous. Socrates got killed for that. Remember, he was censured in Parliament by the Governor General. I think his name was Vanier, V-A-N-I-E-R. He made a statement in Ottawa, in the Parliament, that McLuhan was a dangerous man, and we need to sort of put a stop to him. Are you aware of that?
No, I'm not. I'd be interested to see that. But remember that Vanier headed up a royal commission.
Yes.
And McLuhan was very critical of it, wrote a long article about it in the Varsity newspaper in 1951, I think that was.
Yes. Yeah.
The Vanier Commission, what was it on? On culture in Canada or biculturalism?
Yeah, he says in it, a major cultural activity in Canada is having royal commissions.
Correct. And so that was a critique of the Vanier thing, but it was also a backhanded statement to Innes, because Innes spent the last 10 years of his life being on multiple royal commissions, including one in Winnipeg.
Yes, and he also was at the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions, and I have in my archives a pamphlet from that. That's the...
Yeah, I have that somewhere, too.
Yeah, early 50s. And members of the committee of this place includes a Italian prince who attempted a coup in Italy in 1970. Forget the guy's name. But there are – and then McLuhan is making fun of the Club of Ruin, the Club of Rome, which is the same P2 secret society guys – that even Innes was dealing with back in 1950. So it's interesting, when you get on the commissions, there's always going to be one of these hard-edged establishment guys, in there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Sure.
Oh, that, and the other point was, Carpenter, I was saying, you know, he left because he saw McLuhan was going awry, but the point you're making is that everybody becomes part of the dialogue. Carpenter objected to McLuhan hanging out with Hubert Humphrey, the vice president during the Vietnam War. And was it vice president? Yeah, vice president. And he took an ethical stance as McLuhan is getting too close to the beast by doing that. But what Carpenter didn't understand is the chemical body was obsolete. Didn't matter who anybody was, what authority or institution they were with, they were obsolete. So McLuhan had sympathy for them. He's willing to talk to them. You see what I'm saying? So
sure.
Carpenter missed the generosity trend in McLuhan of including everybody.
Well, yeah, but when Carpenter takes that kind of stance, then what he's saying is there are certain things in the world that demand that we let go of ambiguity, right? So it's
yep.
a very Gutenbergian stance.
Yep.
For McLuhan, if there is to be an ethics, it's an ethics that is grounded in ambiguity. And by and large, people cannot understand that.
Yeah.
And so the sort of the modern history of the world is that we're in a Marconi environment where 99.9% of the happenings are attempts to drag us back into the Gutenberg era.
Yeah. Now, all the Davos Conference, the Bilderbergers, the Trilateral Commission, they're all attempts to do that.
Absolutely.
What's that point I wanted to make?
That shows us why the practicality of science that Hegel already talked about, right? The idea that it's useless to talk about the possibility of science. The only way to prove that science is possible in any field is to practice that science, to make it actual, right? So for McLuhan's failure is really the same failure that everybody who can think has always had.
Yeah.
And that is that there has been a general inability to communicate the fact that human beings can know about the plural potentials of every human being, and on the basis of that, can know what it means to found a city, to found a society, to found a civilization. So the fact that no thinker has been able to communicate that is sort of our fate. And it's a fate that when somebody thinks in the 20th century, if they really think, then they have to enter that fate. They have to enter the faith that they are not going to think anything different from what somebody like Plato already thought. And maybe Plato didn't think anything different from what the Egyptians thought 2,500 years before that, right? But in this whole vast field of human experience, all that we've done is create weapons of mass destruction without understanding the human being that lies behind all that.
Yeah. I like Ion's statement. It's not a thinking man's game. Especially
right.
Today.
Well, McLuhan often talked about that, and that actually reminds me of a point I wanted to make, and that is that sometimes both of us talk about processes that are nonverbal, right? So McLuhan often talked about how media affect us nonverbally.
Yes.
What he meant by that is that it's not something that we think about. It's not something that we're aware of. It's not something that we consciously accede to. But when he uses nonverbal in that sense, we have to understand that everything is going on, everything that is going on in those processes is verbal in another sense. And the other sense of verbal is close to tactility.
Yes.
That is to say that there's nothing that goes on in human beings that isn't communicative in some way. Human beings are always presenting themselves to the world in some role that already reflects communication in the interior landscape, right? There's already been a staged presentation of possible roles and a selection made, and that role then realized in the world. And in being realized in the world, there is inherent relationship to other people's roles and to things and to everything that's happening in the world. And all of that is verbal in the sense that the transition, the stages that are reflected in that is what can be called verbality. It's communicative. It's interrelationship, multi-level, etc.
What do you think of the word sub-vocalization?
Yeah, well, that's sub. I don't know that he would say that, but that's close to what the interior landscape is. It's what is when we come to speak, we have always already gone through a process of role selection, and the process of role selection is subverbal in one sense, but in another sense, it's verbal because there's a communication going on. So that tactility, you know, we can say that things like when people talk about singularity, that's inherently non-tactile. But built into the impetus to speak about a singularity is tactility, right? So all of these words, like what the verbal or the tactile or communication,
or the nonverbal, things,
correct. All of these things are subject to ambiguity, and therefore to this spectrum of ambiguity that goes from one extreme of figure ground to the other.
Right. Now, what about the phrase the inner voice? A lot of religious people, literate religious people, talk about follow the inner voice. Is that
right.
Subverbal? Is that mental gesture?
It's all of the above.
Yeah.
Everything is subject to this ambiguity. So in the Gutenberg galaxy, the inner voice was often used to achieve closure, right? I'm going to be directed by this thing that is bigger than me and that knows the way I'm supposed to go, and that's my inner voice, end of story. but the problem is that people have different inner voices, and they may lead in different directions. And from that insight, you can go to the fact that every person is possibly different persons. McLuhan's thinking was often influenced by his mother, who would go on stage and she would impersonate different people, different voices. So there's always a variety of voices we could be, and therefore the inner voice is possibly a kind of ridiculous closure that should not be made. But on the other hand, the inner voice can well be a plural gesture. Somebody can say, for example, the church directs something through a papal bull, and somebody says, no, my inner voice will not allow me to make the modernity oath.
Yes.
That the Catholic Church put forward in the 1880s, I believe it was. So the inner voice, like everything else, is subject to this range of ambiguities.
Yeah, so look at the tetrad for verbum, V-E-R-B-U-M. He has in Et Cetera magazine. Do you have it available?
I can find it fairly readily, I believe.
Yeah, see if you got it, because I think I wanted to say something else. So verbum, okay, so if humans are eternal, then the inner voice, the sub-vocalization, the constant communication that's going on, not necessarily in your native language, that is what's constant, or the citadel of consciousness, the private citadel of awareness. I'm just thinking that what people think as they're in different communicative situations it includes the verbum, which is grunting and mumbling, and maybe emphatic gestures. There's something in all those communication styles that's constant, and that's what a baby may be thinking without knowing words yet, but there's maybe that's what people mean by knowing. So just as we were talking there, I started to think of this constant knowing that people are communicating.
But don't, Bob, when the word constant falls off your lips, don't you automatically think, oops, that's the Gutenberg galaxy?
Of course, yes, but
yeah.
I can't keep interrupting myself. I'd end up like Biden, unable to communicate even in syllables.
Right, well, before we were talking about the fate of lack of communication. It's not the world is going to hell in a handbasket because of this failure of communication. And it's a non-trivial, non-quadrivial problem, you could say.
Yeah.
So I sympathize with what you're saying. We have to have words to speak to each other. That's right. But so McLuhan's whole effort can be seen as one more attempt to communicate what has never been communicated.
Yeah.
So far, he hasn't succeeded, and maybe the role that I have and part of the role you have is to see if we can't help him to succeed.
Yes.
now that he's been dead 40 years.
Yes, help him. We attended the lecture nobody attended, and McLuhan got it right in that lecture. And we're trying to recall it.
That's right. That's right.
So now, of course, if you do that, you will break through into a new territory in some way. Just like, Eliot went beyond the symbolist, Joyce went beyond Aquinas or something. McLuhan went beyond Joyce, Lewis went beyond Bergson or somebody. I was just thinking, I certainly feel very confident that I've arrived at that point, and my bride of 53 years and I are actually going to pull it off and get to this new level of completing it. But you have to wait for that.
I wish you every luck. I don't believe in the diachronic, for one thing.
Yeah.
I don't, and secondly, I don't believe that we come to a point. I believe what happens is that a way of thinking about ambiguity is realized in both senses of realization, such that we kind of go through a door through which we can understand human beings in a whole new way.
Yeah.
This new way we recognize is something that Plato already saw or Aristotle already saw. So we're not being new geniuses or something. all that we're doing by opening that door, or by seeing that the door is open, is going through it and saying, let's rehear, replay, revisit, retrieve what they already knew, and which in our stupidity we forgot or overlooked.
Yeah, okay. So I think I've always wanted to say this, didn't have any opportunities to say it. Traditional poetic vision, people, I guess romantic poetry highlight this a lot. They see a vision of beauty or symmetry or something, and all the world is right. And I think Alexander Pope ends his essay on man with the phrase, you know, whatever is right is right, or whatever is right. Now, many people say that's a satirical statement, but I like to think that McLuhan was presenting an epiphany, a vision of ecology that was happening. Have you ever...
Yes, I agree with that.
Yeah. You know what I mean? That he saw that things were interacting according to the laws of media with the different sensory modalities and the extensions, and he was... you know, blessed with a vision of harmony in the world, even though
correct.
It was a world that was plagued by new problems, new questions that no one ever admitted to before. And he was in the middle discussing those problems. But if you look at, he wasn't what he was saying. He had a perspective like we imagine the great poets had. And he actually said that through the evergreens. He was taught with the stage of apprehension. And then he explained, well, he didn't get it right. And he said something like, and, you know, someday I could play it. He says, it's a vision. He didn't say, I had a vision. He says, it's a vision. So he had a vision of that, the integrative part of people's brains occasionally have. You know, they have a kind of... serendipity. He has a quote which I can't find, but he talks about the tranquility of the limp wrist. Does that remind you of anything? A sentence. Yeah, I think he's quoting somebody. The tranquility of the limp, dangling hand and wrist. Got to find that, because that's how he. I think he was pointing to the. To this experience of the poetic vision.
Yeah, well, I agree with the impetus of what you're talking about.
Yeah, what I'm trying to get to.
Yeah, but the whole problem is that if you talk about it in terms of vision, in terms of a perspective, then the problem is that it's...
No, that's not what it is. That's why it's the limp wrist. Vision, the way he said it, you know, it was rich. It was tactile. It was haptic. It was not eyeball vision.
Right, right. So, I mean, that's why I say that I agree with what you're saying, but what you're saying inherently has problems to it in the same way as all of the great insights of the great thinkers and great artists have for thousands and thousands of years had problems. That is to say that it's one thing to see harmony in the world, and remember that if there is a spectrum of ambiguities, then that spectrum is a kind of harmony.
Yeah,
you're recognizing a pattern in the world that it's wildly dynamic, but it's also a center of calm.
Yeah,
because it's what you've done is you've gone from something that is wildly opaque to a vision. That excludes nothing and yet is somehow sentenced. So I often in the blog,
would you say somehow sentence? What's that word?
Censored. centered, like a,
centered.
So in the blog, I often talk about gyroscopes.
Yes.
And so you have something that is centered in the sense that it's standing like a top, but it's also dynamic.
Yeah.
And the goal is to be able to articulate that that standing dynamic, as it might be called, in such a way as to generate practical research and practical solutions for problems in the world that seem insoluble.
Right. So you have that phrase, dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions yields the golden section.
Correct. And this, if you go back to Heraclitus, when he says that you can never enter the same river twice, the river is there, but it's dynamic.
Hey.
So this dual vision of sort of a dynamic center has been around forever, but finding a way to articulate it and communicate it is the big problem.
Yeah, have you ever heard Barry Nevin? He added to the point about the river. He said, you can't even step in it once. That was Barry's upgrade of that. Now, the world has come media-wise to a point where everybody is face-to-face with the abyss or with something or with the vision, and they got to make a choice. It would appear is pressuring people, and they get schizoid about making the choice. But there's something unique about, okay, if everybody's been talking the same thing, we now have arrived at a collective consciousness where anybody can see that in the world, the way the media imploded. It's just like 911 was a dramatic performance, but the world had to have the internet first so everybody could have it, right? And McLuhan said once after he died that 911 was obvious. That was the perspective of the astral plane. He said anybody should have seen that coming. So there's a perfect. Remember, he talks about the perfection of communication today, back in the 50s, means that it is hard to reject any cultural claims.
Correct.
Something like that. And
any closure.
Beg your pardon?
Any closure.
Right.
That's what we've been talking about.
Yes. So we have really come to a perfection of communication today with, you know, the people can be incredible broadcasters and narrowcasters and narrow catchers and broadcatchers. There's your tetrad or the four levels. At the same time, there's this ongoing dialogue of the world. Presently, it became imploded around one character, which was more than before. There was the Cold War and all that. So we have one face that makes the word of the market happen. And you know what that face is. And then everybody projects their cultural values or biases on that face. And that face was nominated as the most admired man in America right when the media is saying he's actually nuts as he works out the last 3 weeks of his administration.
Yeah, yeah. I've been thinking a little bit about Trump in because of your book.
Yes.
And it's one thing that you might want to add at some point is the following idea. One of the things that really gets people energized is Trump hotel, Trump golf course, Trump this, Trump that. He's tried to stamp his name on the world, you could say.
Yeah.
And the people that hate Trump hate that.
Yes.
Right? And especially Canadians. You know, Canadians are people that are kind of inherently social and inherently against selfishness.
Yeah, they're like the most Christian literate people.
That's right. Even while they're going about being very selfish.
So
it occurred to me that when Trump labels the whole world as Trump, one of the things he's doing is miming what everybody's doing.
Yes.
Everybody has labeled everything in the world with their stamp, if you will, through the drama of cognition, right? The cognition wouldn't have a drama if it was singular. You know, we don't come into the world and just there it is. Instead, how the world is a result of how we have stamped it. And so the world out there in Maui, it's got Bob Beach and Bob's Burgers and everything, Bob's Palm Trees. Everything is Bob.
Yeah.
And here in Santa Ana, everything I look at is, Cameron's garbage bins and Cameron's Disneyland and all this shit. So everybody does the Trump thing, but they do it unconsciously. And if it's brought out to them, then they hate that. They don't want to know about that.
It's new art. It's ugly.
They don't like anybody that does it, right?
So Trump is the greatest artist today, which was my opening little thing at the beginning of the article. He is the art form that appears, because it's new and it's about our present, he appears ugly to most people.
That's right. But McLuhan talks about this all the time in terms of the monster.
Yes.
Right? And in terms of the Gorgon. Right? So for McLuhan was very interested in horror movies and in cartoon characters that were terribly evil and all this sort of stuff, right?
And the Great Imposter. He loved the Fred Damaris, the Great Imposter.
Yeah, but I mean, that's, to me, that's another thing that's worth thinking about. But
yeah,
it's not related to the monster. For McLuhan, the monster is something. It's almost like a singularity in the way you were talking about it before.
Yeah.
The monster or the Gorgon is something that appears in our culture and that horrifies us, but it's exactly what we need to interrogate.
Yes, we have to have the guts to put up with it.
Yeah, so Trump, in a certain way, is everybody's shadow. Trump is what everybody is doing, but they can't admit that they're doing it, and part of their non-admission is that they reflect it into the world.
Yes.
Right? And so Freud and Jung were very familiar with this kind of mechanism in the psyche, right? Where
the projection.
It's a projection of where something that you have can't be admitted, and therefore the other person has to have it.
Yeah, we've never had the anti-environment in the environment to the degree the White House is the word that makes the market. They've never come together. And McLuhan, one of his first tetrads that he handed out in 74, 75 was when figure becomes ground, it's a monster. I think it was the law of etherealization, where figure becomes ground.
But what he means by when figure becomes ground is that the figure ground ambiguity collapses.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not that figure becomes ground how can I put this? It's often the case in human experience that figure and ground flip. But he's not talking about that. What he's talking about is at the extremes of the spectrum, figure and ground can collapse into each other, and that's the monster, the Gorgon.
Ouroboros.
You're absolutely right about that.
The Ouroboros.
Where the snake has got a tail in its mouth, at the two extremes, when figure and ground collapse, when figure is so great that it subsumes the ground, or when ground is so great that it eats the figure, then the spectrum collapses and the two ends touch each other, because it no longer matters which is figure and which is ground, because that difference, that figure, that structure has collapsed. And
right.
So McLuhan often talked about how a thing that had never been investigated is why one extreme can become the other extreme.
Yes.
And
now, this exactly describes Trump, which is what my book is trying to do.
Uh-huh.
Now, it also means that AI has become human, or human became AI, or artificial intelligence, or the tech body. That's what we're witnessing with Trump. There's something inhuman about the situation. So I go to Zingroni, who thought he'd figured out a way to get past McLuhan, or the world had changed so much that McLuhan's world and knowledge didn't work anymore. So he has
right.
in his book, The Media Simplex, subtitled At the Edge of Meaning in the Age of Chaos. In other words, you don't get to singular meaning. You just get the edge of it. That's your ambiguity. So this came out in 2001, page 246. He says, we want to know whether there is a form/content relationship that holds true for all media of communication. An affirmative
right.
answer to this question is possible. And here's what it is. And you've just been describing it, and it's in italics. He says, content consumes form. That's where the figure becomes so monstrous. And then it collapses into each other. And then he says, how could The Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, or La Dolce Vita be imagined apart from their medium's form, which has entered and become fused with content? No matter how spectacular the production values of a film, the contents of that film consume it. So that could be describing Trump's presidency or Trumpism.
Wait. The reason that a lot of the stuff that you say about Trump is interesting is that you preserve ambiguities.
Yeah.
Right? Everything you said from Zingroni's book reeks of the Gutenberg galaxy.
Yes.
Right? It's diachronic. We're going to go beyond McLuhan. And notice that there's a million books out there that have to do with beyond McLuhan or
yes.
beyond Heidegger or beyond Plato or whatever. So we have all of these diachronic, continuous clock time people. And they always, as we said before, they always aim at a singularity. And here's Zingroni at the end of his book saying that content eats the form, right? And,
yes.
And therefore becomes singular.
Yeah.
Right?
So
it's not interesting. It's interesting only as a sample to be investigated for McLuhan.
Yes. Now listen to this. So Eliot says, you know, in Sweeney Agonistes, I got to use words when I talk to you. Well, media has, Gutenberg media, analog media has become so available to everybody to produce that Zingroni is expressing what everybody should be saying. The update is, I apologize for, I've got to use books to communicate with you. It's not words. That's too easy. That's back when, you know, 100 years ago when nobody had access to big major media environments. Now we do in our digital world. So everybody's
right.
writing books. And a lot of the humanities is just people putting out a book every few years, and it's just quotes from their reading in their life as a professor. They're just telling you what they read. And they try to put in some kind of order, which doesn't work, or it's irrelevant. But they've got to use publish and perish, eh? They've got to use books to talk to us. That's the new totalitarianism. Before, it used to be language. Now it's books and maybe movies and blogs and video.
Right. So just when you're thinking about that stuff, keep in mind the fundamental ambiguity. So McLuhan oftentimes was criticized for saying that we've reached the end of the book, and then people would come out with 20 books in their hand, and they would say, look, there's more books now than there ever was. What are you talking about? And McLuhan would then say, just because something is obsolete, it doesn't mean that it's completely disappeared. It may mean that we have more of them than ever.
Yes.
You see that in cars, or you see that in pollution. You see it in everything. It's a law of media that things,
because they are not the key word that you got to learn from McLuhan is constitutive. Books are not constitutive. The electronic vortex is what's constitutive in his day. You understand? It's what shapes the ground, or it's the ground that shapes the medium, which is all the past media.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Constitutive
was his way of saying, well, this is a more shaping thing than anything that you're talking about. Not you, but people in the news. The constituent is the 10% that's not noticed or not realized how powerful
right.
it is.
But the word constitutive points towards the drama of cognition.
Yeah.
And the drama of cognition, people shouldn't think, oh, that's something that happens to individuals. We don't really know much about the drama of cognition, but there are certainly social aspects to it. There may even be global aspects to it. So we need to be able to leave a lot of these terms to an investigation, which we hope is going to happen. But having said all that, the word constitutive is automatically points to a lot of the stuff that we've talked about today. That is to say that when something happens, that something can be a perception, or it can become the way the academic universe demands publications, and or it can be the event of modern history that we have this superfluity of content and it means nothing.
Right.
The word constitutive means that all of these things have a history, but it's not a diachronic history. It's a synchronic history, a vertical history that has to do with how these things came to be. And so really, there's a sense in which McLuhan never talks about anything but being, right? What is the complexity of being such that all these things have come to be? How can we interrogate everything that is so that we understand the fundamental structures of being that lie behind it? So this relates to what you were talking about with the vision that poets or philosophers or
right.
Religious people or whoever have had. McLuhan had a certain notion of existence in which harmony or inclusivity, as he would probably rather say, in which inclusivity is the fundamental law, right? That you... spectrum of ambiguities, which goes from one figure ground to another figure ground, in the middle is a notion that figure and ground are fitted to each other and are in harmony in their difference. And so for McLuhan, what's necessary is for people to come to that middle and then to articulate it through practical applications in the world. And he wasn't able to bring that off, unfortunately, but the tradition and the demand that that happen in the world is something that is very much alive. And I see you as one of the people that understands that and is trying to articulate it.
Yes. Well, I'm glad of that, that you see that. So I said, let's start looking at the quotations in the book. So I want to take you to the first quotation.
That's fine.
And it's, I don't know where, oh, this comes from Stern, I think, Hot and Cool. Okay, so the quote is, the first one is, in the light of all that you've been saying, and I've been adding to, have you gotten to the first quotation yet?
Yeah, the one about it, octopus attacking yes. the Great Pyramids. Yeah.
Yeah. The road to understanding media effects begins with arrogant superiority. If one lacked this sense of superiority, this detachment, it would be quite impossible to write about them, media effects. It would be like an octopus attacking the Great Pyramids. So
right.
there is this general principle.
Right.
Then it's applied 13 years later, late 70s, is when the second quote comes forth. It's an unpublished interview with some guy that I got from George Thompson, I think. So listen to this. Pollster activities are all espionage, snooping on publics. The whole credit system is based on espionage. By the way, you can find out all the secret life of anybody by buying it from a crediting agency. It is a new kind of activity, and it may well undermine our political life because it has been discovered that in every single case of representatives in politics, there is a conflict of interest. You cannot be a representative of a big sector of the public without having conflicts of interest between your job and your role-playing and your private interests. And so the discovery of the conflict of interest, which is really the whole issue in Watergate, has in a sense overturned our political life. I know that right here in Canada, there's nobody in politics who doesn't have a conflict of interest. Many lawyers go into politics, and by definition, they have a conflict of interest. Any lawyer has a conflict of interest in politics. He's using his political position to obtain for himself new clients and new connections at all times. That's how he gets into politics in the first place. Now, can you imagine walking into the, you know, Parliament in Ottawa and making this, what sounds like an accusation, but it's typical of the dangerous statements he'd make that he got away with. Either no one knew it, this one didn't get published, but he is talking about the issues of the 70s right there. And he's got the controversial themes of espionage and snooping and spying, and you can buy information and blackmail somebody because nobody in the, I like the way he says it, representative of a big sector of the public, those are big environments, old media, doesn't have a conflict of interest. What do you say about that quote?
No, I think, well, first off, I think they're both great quotes. I think it's a super way to begin thinking about modern times, if you will.
Yeah.
And understanding what McLuhan might contribute to an understanding of them. When he says it would be like an octopus attacking the Great Pyramids, one of the things that you might think about is alchemy, right? The alchemy had seeds to it that led to chemistry. Those seeds weren't the only thing that led to chemistry, but they were important seed. But alchemy ultimately did not have a way of articulating what was going on with physical reality. It was like an octopus attacking the Great Pyramids, and that had to be straightened out. So then you come to the second quote, and he's talking about a conflict of interest in politics, but he could just as well have been talking about a conflict of interest in academia.
Yeah.
And there, he did get into trouble. He did have huge problems at University of Toronto and eventually almost everywhere.
Yeah.
Because the last thing that people wanted to admit was that they had a conflict of interest. But the whole point of the way McLuhan thought about things, he says, you cannot be a representative of a big sector of the public without having conflict of interest between your job and your role-playing and your private interest. So if we take that down to the drama of cognition, right? Everybody is a representative of, quote unquote, a big sector of the public. Everybody is a representative of all of the possible roles that that person could be playing. That's what the public is.
Yeah.
The public is, McLuhan always talked about Yeats' 1903 short piece on multitude, right? So every human being is sitting on top of a multitude.
Yeah, and they're not public, they're mass manned.
No. Well,
remember, public is a literate Gutenberg public.
Yeah. In order to understand the words we're using, we have to specify what's figure and what's ground.
Yeah.
So what I'm talking about here is the public or the mass man as ground, not as figure.
Okay.
Whereas, you were talking about it in terms of figure. So what I'm saying is everybody at all times is a representative of the public. That is to say, everybody is a certain role on top of all of the possible roles that he or she could be playing, right? So that the idea of a representative of the public is what everybody is all the time. And there's always a conflict of interest because we want to portray that role playing and that identity as who we are. But that's a private interest, as he says, imposed on what is a public drama.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
So what he's talking about here in terms of politics could be articulated in terms of academia, but it's also what you and I and everybody is doing at every second. So we always have a conflict of interest, and most of life goes on in the denial of it.
Yeah, what is it? Everybody is crew on Spaceship Earth? No spectators.
Absolutely. Yeah, but that's a way of that would be a way of actually beginning to admit the conflict of interest.
You know, they say this guy who lives in Washington D.C. told me that 70% of the public, American public, doesn't vote. They don't follow politics. So you got 30% are engaged in it, and that's split to 15%. So, small part of the population determines the figures. But I think the 70% are people aware of what you just explained. And they recognize the conflict of interest, so they're not going to specialize and become a politician or something. Just the worst become politicians. And that's in the old-fashioned terms of worst. We still would talk to them, be sympathetic to their being on the spot. But I'm trying to say that the public is quite smart or has been forced by default to become smart by such a 24/7 educational environment going on all the time. So that by the 50s, McLuhan could say we're at the highest decibels of consciousness. Well, we're really at an incredible level of informed. And that's the silent majority.
Mm-hmm. But the
not based on values or voting or party membership. It is describing, our quadriphenic wearing of all these environments.
Correct. So there, too, we must preserve the ambiguity of all things. Part of the inherent wisdom of the public, and perhaps especially of the 70% that doesn't give a shit about politics because politicians are not interested in us, right? Part of the inherent wisdom of that 70% is their roots in tradition. They know that change is usually for the worse, that great ideas usually lead to bullshit, that the less a politician does, the better it is. The less we pay in taxes, the better it is. So and that wisdom is age old, is rooted in the soil, and is just what everybody knows, right?
Yeah.
So they, and then on the other hand, they have what everybody is learning through the new media environment, right? Which is what you were just talking about.
Yep.
So for McLuhan, one of the things that his conversion to Catholicism represented is it possible to bring those together in some way? Not in a bare identity, but is there a way to think about the ambiguities of all things, the co-presence of all media, in a way that allows us to say in a new way everything that's good about the old ways?
Yes. What does that entail today? Nothing old under the sun and nothing new under the sun.
Correct.
Old is new, new is old. But then again, we have to be ambiguous about your statement there, because there is nobody can remember the old traditions unless they are acting them out anyways. Can't help it.
Correct. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So that's the silent sea. We've broken into the silent sea. So we have endless communication because it's obsolete. In other words, there's going to be more and more of it. But people are forced to live in silence. That's the 70%, the silent majority.
Right.
So what would academics teach young people? He has in take today that academia is the last mirage of capitalism. People
right.
competing individualistically for grants.
Yep.
The grant grubbing. So the academics, they say, well, I'm leaving the dirty business world and I'm going to have a leisurely life of study and I'm going to become smarter by doing this and I'll be a model citizen. And yet the environment, they actually become more what they didn't want to be anymore, a businessman in the academic situation. So, again, conflict of life, conflict of contradictions, conflict of interest. So academia is on the spot. So we have endless talking heads. Academia aspires to get on CNN and be a talking head. That's apparently you've arrived when you're like Alan Dershowitz or somebody. That's the great hypocrisy of our time.
Even in the college environment, you're a talking head, right? You're a talking
yes.
head. If you're lecturing, then you go to a conference and there's a panel and you become a talking head on the panel. That's all. Yeah. So yeah, it's just talking heads. And obviously the uselessness of that is a huge part of the practical problems of the world. So when McLuhan began to speak about the medium as a message, this was 1958, right away he was saying to Harry Skornia that the problem of the academic world from kindergarten to post-grad is that this is a world that's divided from the practical world, right? If we do chemistry at any level of education, that's not a different chemistry from what is done in research labs and in manufacturing and whatever. So the in chemistry, there is no wall that divides the classroom from the world. And the taking down of that wall is the important contribution of chemistry. Alchemy still had that wall and was proud of it. Chemistry took it down and the world was revolutionized. So for McLuhan, when he says the medium is the message, he says to Harry Skornia at exactly the same time, what we have to do is recognize that we also have a classroom without walls. The people are learning more outside of the classroom than inside. And if we are going to have effective education, we must recognize that that wall has fallen, and education needs to be directed by an awareness of that fallen wall. So the sign for McLuhan that people are going to understand the medium as a message is that what is taught at any level of education is going to be the same thing that's going on in the world at large. However, let's say that was in 1958, so that's more than half a century ago. The whole academic world has done nothing since that time but attempt to maintain the wall. So yep. When you were just talking about capitalism, the leisurely study and all this sort of bullshit, that is attempts to maintain the wall that can't exist if we are going to have proper education.
Right. Now, the poetic visionary thing is that's part of the inevitable fate of the university. He said in the Dew Line, it became the new city. The inevitable thing is that it is part of the ecology. There's so many people not engaging in academia now. They're doing other things. So there is an underlying harmony in activities. Just depends on which part of the public sectors you get stuck in and then think you're stuck there. Always remember you're discarnate and you're not where you appear to be according to your eyes. Like when you read the New York Times, it's not a New York paper. It's covering the solar system. You're not in New York when you're experiencing the New York Times, so it's mistitled.
Everything's subject to ambiguity, right? So
yes.
Nothing is more universal than the New York Times, and nothing is more local.
Yes.
Right? The New York Times has a very parochial view of truth and of journalism. And it's to read the cosmos through the New York Times is to put blinkers on.
Yes.
It's to see nothing, basically. So it's one more thing that's subject to an unacknowledged ambiguity.
Right. What was that quote from the 50s, I think, about the, but it might be in Counterblast, the later Counterblast, the baby powder gets in our eyes. We're in a new situation.
Yeah. And right.
A new cradle, and the baby powder gets in our eyes.
Yeah. I think that's all part of the hanging to the chandelier by our ears passage, isn't it?
I don't recall that sentence being part of it, but it might be. I think it's just one page.
But anyway, I know what you're talking about, the powder getting in our eyes. Yep.
Okay, so did you ever encounter an educational academic movement of clarity, as we're talking about it, lucidity? Is there any movement of anything, maybe pretending to replenish the public, that you have ever experienced?
Well, when McLuhan was asked questions like this, he would always say, you have to understand that opposites flip. And what's happened just in the last few years is that it's become painfully obvious that education has only one view. The Ivy League and the best colleges all enforce a single view of the world, and that it sort of contradicts the whole idea of education.
Yes.
And yet all of these colleges have huge billion-dollar endowments and are businesses, capitalism at its worst, as you were just saying. So what seems to be happening is that we're getting a coalescence of insistence on Gutenberg that is so lopsided and so stupid and so unenlightened that at some point it's going to flip. And we don't know what's going to happen when it flips. It can be a very dangerous thing, or it could be something very good. But it's the present situation is unstable.
Yeah.
And signs of this are that colleges increasingly fund their sciences and defund their humanities. So anybody who thinks that they're going to get a PhD in comparative lit and then get a job is nuts. there are no jobs. People that had jobs in comparative lit are out looking for jobs themselves. They're not looking in academia.
That's right.
So, the whole situation is one of we've entered a singularity and we don't know what's going to happen.
Right. And let me end with this. So there was this grad student who started a blog and interviewing tended to be media ecology professors. I think it was called Figure Ground. It was an Argentinian student.
Yeah, a guy at Simon Fraser.
Yes, British Columbia, yeah. So he interviewed me. And,
oh, good.
Uh-huh. And my main point was immigrant people coming to the promised land, North America, hoping to get their kids to have a good education. I said, that's the biggest scam going. I urge them not to sweat their balls off to raise money, save money to send their kids to university. That's going to really cause problems. So I recommend they don't go to university. In other words, undermine the vision that was bringing them to North America. So the guy published it, and immediately the regular, MEA, media ecology gang, they pounced on him, said, you cannot have this in this thing that's talking about us great media ecologists and wonderful new world we're describing or studying. So if you don't get rid of Bob's interview, I will not grant you my interview, which was coming, or I will tell you to take it down. So he stuck to his, quote, guns and kept it up for a few years. And then a few years ago, I noticed it wasn't there anymore. So I wrote to him, emailed him, no answer. Then I chided him 6 months later. So, once a year I bug him. I say, you're a coward. But I found out that he got a job teaching somewhere. So he had to join the cult. So he had to take it off. Even though while he was what is McLuhan saying? Oh, about being? That 40s essay, the non-being of non-being.
Fine. Yeah, that was a paper he wrote at the University of Manitoba in 1933.
Yes, so that's, you talk about being, there he is talking about the non-being of non-being. So check that one out. But he stopped taking a stand, fell to, tribal pressure? Professional pressure, hypocrisy, and finally had to delete me. But as a student, McLuhan used to say, when you're becoming and you're a young person with potential, everybody's interested in you. Once you arrive at some place, nobody cares about you anymore. You've come to the platform of specialization, I guess, and you're no longer in the process of becoming. So don't be ambiguous about arriving.
Because don't be or be. I would say he's saying be ambiguous about arriving.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Be ambiguous about arriving.
Absolutely.
So that opens it all up. Everybody's 4 years old, and you can talk to anybody. Don't be a snob. Unless it's ecologically appropriate, depending on the environment you're in, right? Maybe if I was caught in an ISIS camp, a terrorist camp, I wouldn't act like a snob. I'd hide in the middle.
Yeah. Bob, as you were saying, we're at a time when we can call it quits for today.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that you just brought up a very excellent topic for next week or sometime, and that is the destruction of the idea of America as the shining city on a hill.
Yeah.
Reagan could say that, and most Americans thought that it was appropriate to say it and was an appropriate description of who they were. So that was around the time that just after McLuhan died.
Yes.
And so in the 40 years since, roughly, what we've seen is the destruction of that idea.
Yeah.
And that is one of the sort of fundamental forces at work in American politics and, in fact, in international politics. And if we examine that destruction sort of from a McLuhan angle, I think we'll be on to something very fruitful.
Okay,
and in accord with your book, by the way.
Yes, make a note of that, or maybe even type it up as we hang up and send me an email so we will remember. We got to do that. And
yeah.
The main statement McLuhan made in the 60s was that America had become a world environment. So there's a beginning point. We're not a world environment anymore. We're something else.
Yeah. Well, or a world environment, but for the detriment to the world.
Yeah.
Right. And of course, as you know, even better than I do, this world environment idea of McLuhan came directly from Lewis, Cosmic Man.
Yeah.
So McLuhan took Lewis's idea, which was relatively optimistic and not unhappy with America. And McLuhan, as a more of a Canadian than Lewis could ever be, turned that on its, if not exactly on its head, at least turned it in an ambiguous way.
Yep. It's an ambiguous situation. And so in that ambiguous situation, I became an American citizen 3 years ago.
Wow. Just, why, to have multiple passports or?
No, so that because my bride and I are carrying out a revolution, we could be deported at any time. So I just wanted to frustrate it by being an American citizen because I don't want to leave Maui.
Yeah, yeah. No, I understand. Yeah, no, that's a passport as a way of dealing with deportation, I think, is an idea I've also had, but I've just I've never been able to pull the trigger on the idea of
you never could commit suicide. You just couldn't do it. Okay.
That's right.
We'll see how long you can do that luxurious position. Okay, so fantastic conversation. Awesome.
All right. Well, thanks, Bob. I appreciate the opportunity, and I have fun doing it.
Right. And to quote Sherman Skolnick, the Chicago investigator, legend, who Joe Keough, who has maybe the greatest correspondence with McLuhan in the archives. You know Joe Keough.
I know of him, but I don't know much about him.
Yeah, he was an incredible correspondent with McLuhan, and he helped edit the Gutenberg Galaxy as a student in the early 60s. But anyways, Joe knew and used to listen to Sherman Skolnick in the Chicago area in the late 60s, early 70s. Skolnick always ended his program with, "It's been a real pleasure to hear the treasury of your wisdom, Cameron."
As long as we remember the ambiguity to that.
That's right. I'll remember, especially after hearing you for 2.5 hours go on about it. How can I forget?
Well, the key to being able to talk for some time is talking with a knowledgeable interviewer.
Yes.
So, one of the things that people should appreciate when they think of how dangerous or how stupid or how crazy or something your ideas are, is that your idea is only one part of Bob. There's many other parts, and one of the parts that's especially valuable is your ability to listen to people in such a way as to become conduct a good interview.
Very good. I'm glad you noticed that. I am a pretty good interviewer.
No question about it.
Okay. All right. Great. We'll talk next week in the new year.
So, yes, sir. Happy New Year to you.
Same to you. Okay. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.